Hello, everybody, and welcome to Turning Towards Life. This is Lizzie and Justin from Third Space, and we are here again for another week of conversation. And welcome to all of you, wherever you are, all over the world, and spread through time because of the magic of podcasting and YouTube. And welcome, Lizzie. It's really, really good to be with you again. You have brought us a wonderful source for us to talk about, which we'll come to in a moment. But just to say to everyone who's with us, the way this works is every week we take a source, a rich source of thinking or feeling, idea or exploration. We'll both read it in a couple of minutes, and then a whole conversation will unfold from that. And we've been doing this for, I think this is our 386th week of conversation. So if you're new to us and you want to delve into the very rich and deep archives, you can head over to turningtowards.life or find us on any of the podcast apps or on YouTube, and you'll find all of the previous conversations and sources there for you to explore, which is a wonderful resource. Lizzie, I don't know if this happens to you, but every now and again, somebody will email me or email us, which you can do at hello@turningtowards.life or Lizzie or Justin at turningtowards.life, and say, did you ever talk about fear, or did you ever talk about love, or did you ever talk about something that's very live in that person's life? And then we root around in the archives, and often I'll send something to people. But you can also go and search. If you go to turningtowards.life, you can search there and find what we've talked about before. And I know that many of these conversations turn out to be very helpful for many of you in very many different situations in your life. And whilst you're there, if you want, you can subscribe to our email list, which brings these conversations into your inbox every week. And there are ways to support us there too, if you feel so moved to do something beyond listening or watching. There are ways that you can get involved and help this great endeavor keep going, which we're always very grateful for. So I have nothing more to say, Lizzie, apart from welcome to you, and thank you for bringing us this source this week.
Thank you, Justin. I was just thinking how much I don't like podcasts when there's adverts on them, and how this kind of little sweet preamble that we do is so different to an advert for, I don't know, milkshake or something or whatever. And I'm so grateful that we get right into it. I really am. So welcome everybody from me as well. And Justin, thank you for being here as always. So this source is called Children Learn What They Live, and it's by a woman called Dorothy Law Nolte, and it's from an article in a family column from the Torrance Herald newspaper in 1954. And I came across this, Justin, because when I was, you'll know, Justin, I forgot to post a source this week on Friday, and I've been on my own all weekend with the children, since Friday morning. So I really had very little capacity to think about poetry or writing or anything. And I often think, my goodness, if I had done this after I'd had children, like as in begun this after I'd had children, I would never have begun it. So I'm grateful that we began when we did, because it's so full life. And anyway, I'd forgotten, and I thought, what am I thinking about at the moment? What do I want to wonder about more? And so when they were asleep on Saturday night, I started thinking, well, people keep saying this thing about the biggest price our children pay is for the unlived dreams of the parents. And I've often wondered about that and thought, oh, it's so confusing. Like, what does that even mean? Anyway, my sister and I are into this big inquiry about Jungian psychotherapy at the moment and what it means. And a big part of that is dream work. And I know, Justin, you've talked and wondered and delved into your own dreams a lot. And so my dreams are becoming a different thing now. My dreams are becoming like invitations to process and wondering what on earth is going on inside my bonkers unconscious. And it kind of dawned on me that essentially, I think what that thing is saying, and I think it's Jung who said it about the unlived life of the parents is what the children pay for. I think it's about this dream work thing, which is that if I'm not onto my unconscious patterns, my children will bear the brunt of all of them and I won't even know it's going on. And I brought this source not only because I'm parenting, because yes, I am, but that that's not the first port of call with this source. I would really like us to listen to it, Justin, from the point of view of our inner parent. And Justin, you and I are going to be embarking soon on this wonderful work again of parts and process, where we're looking at what it means to essentially find our self with the big self, being a parent to all of our different parts that arise, our young ones, our protectors, our wounded ones, all those ones inside. And so I felt like this poem was something of a link between the unconscious and wondering what that is and how that plays out in our lives, and how we might build and cultivate parts that have us feel well, that have us feel seen, that have us feel safe. And I came across this because I just Googled unlived life of parent impact on child. I love my Google searches. And because I wanted to find a source on it so I could talk with you about it and see what it came to mean, Justin. And this amazing Google search brought up like a ton of brilliant therapists' websites. And so I scrolled through all these therapist websites thinking, oh my gosh, how wonderful, all these people are doing this work. And it was really wonderful. And somebody had this poem on their website. And it made me think about my inner parent and the way I speak to myself and how that then translates on how I speak to my children. And as I said, the first port of call on all of this in any conversation about the way we hold our power, basically, and parenting is one of the, I think, ultimate powers that we hold. And we're powerful in all different roles and ways, whether we're a manager or a leader or in a relationship with someone. We have all these different kinds of power. And I feel like holding this inquiry of what our own inner parent, of course, maybe informed by our own parents or our systems that we got brought up in. If I'm onto my own inner parent and working with that, maybe there's a really big and rich, and I know there is, field of inquiry and inner work and healing that can happen. So anyway, that's a massive preamble to this source, but it feels important to say it so that I'm not just kind of bringing this is what one should do as a parent or something. Like, the context feels really important to me. So that's why I'm talking a lot at the beginning here. But anyway, we're going to read and see where this goes. So here we go. Children learn what they live. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world.
Thank you, Lizzie. So as always, I'm going to read it too. And a reminder that if you're listening or watching with us, you can find this on the turningtowards.life website or in the show notes that go out in all of the different forms or in our Facebook group. So this is Children Learn What They Live by Dorothy Law Knott. If a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If a child lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world.
Thank you, Justin. Oh, so all the bits I said before, I would like to say again, in a way. But when you were reading, the thing that arose in me is I often wonder what kind of pattern gave rise to the things in me. Like, how come I feel ashamed of this? Or how come I feel guilty about this? Or how come this makes me want to fight? Or how come I feel so judgmental about this thing? And what I really enjoyed about this from Dorothy is that it kind of helped me link certain things to happenings in my life. And in a way, it's all in service of things becoming conscious that haven't been conscious before. So when I feel into my shyness, I was literally, as I was reading this, feeling into these different aspects of myself, I could feel all of the ways that I had felt ridiculed when I was little, and I hadn't linked them to my shyness necessarily. And then this shame and guilt one, it's like, oh my gosh, yes, I can feel that when there was a kind of atmosphere of shame, I couldn't help but feel anything but guilt, because the partner to guilt is shame. And so I found it really enlightening to look at each of the lines and think, my goodness, when the soup I was swimming in was that, I couldn't have been anything other than that, because it kind of determined and gave me the space that was the shape of guilt to be in when there was an atmosphere of shame. And so then I also wondered about all of the more wholesome parts of this, of appreciation and faith and liking oneself and patience and confidence. And I could also feel all of those things too, that there was a way that this was pointing to both the places to heal, but also the places to appreciate. And I liked that there was a kind of inequality about it, like my unconscious might hold, I mean, goodness knows, my dreams are so out there and strange. I sometimes do not know whether they're just a strange fancifulness or something that I don't know. And other times I can feel the meaning in them and the symbolic stuff in them and whatever. But I like that this had both this invitation that I could be unconscious about all of the security I experienced, and I could be unconscious about all of the shame I experienced. And that there's all these different aspects of life that when partnered this way is a really useful and helpful uncovering of some happenings and patterns in me that then show me to myself that it's brought to the light. And then as that happens, I can then see that playing out with my relationships in the world, specifically and especially where I hold a certain type of power. So I'm very kind of shaken, if you know what I mean. Like, you know, when you read something and it kind of like unsettles the bottom of the lake, so it's now kind of murky, where it was quite clear before. And the clarity is really welcome, but also the muddiness is really welcome, because it kind of means that something is being uncovered, something new is happening in my inner world, where I'm like, I don't know anymore. What if I start to look at shame and wonder about guilt? It's like a whole load of mud gets thrown up, and I wonder what's there. And that's what I felt like this did for me, is it really showed me some mud so that I could begin to start. And then who knows, dreams might come now. It's like I feel related to my dream life in a different way, where when I'm intentionally in conversation about things that are not so conscious in me, then new waves of dreams come that show me different things and bring back memories and are symbolic in particular ways. And I'm really appreciating that kind of part of my human process, where different things get invited to be encountered and shown in my development.
So I realize, Lizzie, when I first read this source, which I've seen before somewhere, I realized that there would be deeper and shallower ways of reading this. You could read this as a sort of shaming the parents kind of deal here. But what you're inviting us to do is to use it in service of something incredibly important that I think many of us don't necessarily get enough support within our lives, or maybe don't often attend to enough, but is so rich and life-giving, which is to treat ourselves like a great mystery, to be inquired into and observed and uncovered. So there's a way in which we might think that we know ourselves, but we're also really sort of strangers to ourselves in a way. We got born into a who knows what that was already there, and then we started to get formed in the middle of that soup, I think you called it, or the context. And that formed us and also formed the, you were talking about the dynamic of inner parts, all the protective parts of us and the parts of us that got pushed away and everything, all of that got formed there. And there was the relationship with our caregivers, which might have been our parents, but might not have been, and the people who taught us in school, if we got to go to school, and our relatives and other adults that we knew. And also they were all swimming in the sea or the soup of what came before them. And so we think we know ourselves, but actually we got formed in this great mystery, and there's such value then in looking and wondering with great patience and attention and curiosity to see what gets revealed, either by patiently observing or by writing or by asking other people to talk to us about us, or by inquiring into the very particular kinds of dreams that get evoked in us. It's all such rich territory. So I'm really glad for your invitation to read this like that, because that's not the only way to read this. And what I got thinking about whilst you were talking was, you know, oh, of course, there are questions for me to ask myself about all the places where I condemn, or I fight, or I'm shy, or where I feel guilty before I've even opened my mouth. And also the places in me, or where I get to be patient, or have confidence, or appreciate, or have faith, or cherish, or like myself, or find love. Even just beginning to notice that all of those are patterns in me. And that's the way I want to read this. I don't want to read this like a sort of blame game against parents, like, you awful parent, you raised a child who learns to condemn, so you must have criticized. It's so unhelpful. But what is helpful is, oh, there are ways in which in me there's a whole vast world of responsiveness to the world which I've lived through. And I can start to look at what in me, for example, condemns. And there's lots in me that does, by the way. Often, sometimes condemnation is very appropriate. I want to say that. But I'm interested in the condemnation or the fight or the shyness or the guilt that comes up sort of even before I've made any kind of useful assessment about anything. Like, oh, there it is. Like you said, there are, we, all of us, wield power in our lives in various ways. Even if we're structurally very powerless, we might, you know, there's big things happening in the world of international affairs and politics and things happening right now as we're recording this, big shifts in the world. Most of us have no direct purchase on that, but we do have power when it comes to our parenting or our partnering or our working with other people. And so the sense that you're inviting us into, which is to really pay attention to and to be curious about, how does the way that power shows up, how does the way that I act show up in me that is shaped by what came before and will also be shaping who I'm around? This isn't just true of children. You know, this is true of all of our interactions. We're bringing each other into the world all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very taken by the curiosity of this. And I want to just say one other thing, which is related to the parenting part. And I can't remember. I'm always reading lots of books simultaneously, and I cannot remember which book I read this thing in. I think it's something I'm reading at the moment. Was pointing out that up until the 19, maybe even the time of the Second World War, but certainly the previous century, most people in the world, if you weren't part of the aristocracy, were subject to the power of others in ways that's quite unknown to us now. You know, like a lord or a, you know, where someone could dictate you, Lizzie, you can or you can't work. You know, you can or you can't be this kind of person. So there was a kind of parenting that had to evolve for many, many people, which is that if you didn't get made strong in a particular way, you'd probably just be trampled by the system. You'd be dead. And that's different in many ways to the world we've made now, although there are all kinds of power imbalances and everything. And reading that reminded me that a lot of the way power got used when we were all growing was the best effort that the adults around us could make, given what had happened to them, to try and make sense of a world. If we weren't in an abusive situation, if we were not in that situation. So the reason I'm saying all of this is that the who you get to be and who I get to be now is shaped not only by our parents, but by their parents and by their parents and by their parents and by their parents. And it's like we're swimming in this great stream that came down to us. And I suppose what you're asking of us is, given that, I mean, it's the way I'm hearing your question, given that, what to do? What to do now, knowing that that's been playing its part?
Yeah, and the importance for me, Justin, of consciousness, like knowing what's happening, seeing what's happening, being reflective about one's own life, and then in that reflection, wondering whether if anything might be different. So I remember, Justin, calling my hilarious granddad up, who was one of those eccentric people in the world in a very particular way. He was called Grumpy. And that's what my grandmother said that we should call him, because he was grumpy. But he really loved us. You know, there was no chance that he didn't love us all. I was very lucky to have a granddad until I was in my late 30s. He died when he was 96. So a full, you know, eccentric expression of himself. And I remember calling him up when I was maybe, I don't know, 9 or 10 or something, and telling him I got 9 out of 10 in a spelling test. And without missing a beat, he'd say, well, what about the other point then? Dead serious. Really genuinely asking me, why didn't I get 10 out of 10? And I remember having picked up the call with such joy. Like, I got 9 out of 10. I only got 1 wrong. You know, that was how I had received it in my structures. And then that's when the kind of inner criticism began, you know, of, oh, maybe I should be looking at what I didn't achieve versus what I did achieve. And that's something that I really want to undo. So if I wasn't conscious of that, if I hadn't reflected on that, if I hadn't understood myself as that little 10-year-old and wondered what impact that had, and then looked at what impact it did have in my life and my education and the way that I received things that weren't 100% perfect, which of course nothing really ever is. If I hadn't have done that, I would be saying that to my children and people around me. I wouldn't be appreciating what they had done. I would be pointing to all the things that they hadn't done or what they didn't achieve. And that's a very particular piece of ancestry, like you said, like the soup of it all. And of course, my granddad probably at some point had to be perfect at something. He was a signalman in the Navy in the Second World War. If he got that wrong, death, you know? So I feel like I'm really wanting to not throw it back at him, if you know what I mean, like not criticize him, but to feel encouragement for him and tolerance for him and approval for him for being the way that he was, but also being conscious that that's not something that I want to take forward. Because it's right now, it's not necessary. Death is not on the line in a spelling test. But of course, for him, everything was life and death in one way because of the particular kind of trauma and the time in history that he lived, which is really not very long away from right now. And so I was in receipt of all of his stories, of all of the horrors of the things that happened to him, what he had to do to put that aside, to be a parent and to live. And so when I'm being an advocate for this kind of consciousness, it comes with love. You know, it comes with honoring. It comes with understanding and compassion and choices too. So it's not that I'm kind of writing something off in order to be something else. I don't think that dynamic has worked for me anyway, because it's the same thing going on as I'm judging you and I'm trying to change, but actually my judgment is not healed. It's not a gentle place in me. It's a reactive, or I'm in response or reaction to that thing, rather than coming from a genuine inclusive place of, I understand that, I have compassion for that, and I'm not going to take that forward, is a very different place than I'm never ever going to be like that, and I'm shoving it into the shadowy box of neverness. But living it forward from a place of understanding. And that for me is the kind of the beauty of this invitation to our unconscious and the things that we just do as kind of habit. So that when I do have someone who comes to say, I got 9 out of 10, I have a choice as to whether I respond as in a, well, what happened to the other one thing, or, my goodness, how does that feel? How do you feel? You know, let me just leave myself out for a moment of whether I think 9 out of 10 is good enough or whatever. But how do I center the person in front of me and say, well, so tell me, what does that feel like to get 9 out of 10 in your spelling test? Which is a really different response than I received. But it comes from, as I said, like an understanding and a love and a choice at the same time.
Well, and all of that makes me think, Lizzie, when you're talking just now about the kind of attention you might bring to someone else when they come to you with this, and that your response to them of, what are you experiencing now as you're telling me about your 9 out of 10 in the test, is an enormously respectful way of inviting somebody else to be attentive to their own experience in a way that we're not when we're running on automatic. If I come to you and tell you about 9 out of 10 and I'm actually embarrassed and ashamed, Whatever you say to me is likely to be shaped by my own inner embarrassment and ashamedness. And if we have the kind of relationship where you can say to me, what's it like to say that? And I can say, gosh, actually, Lizzie, I feel very proud of my 9 out of 10, or I feel something in me feels a bit ashamed about it because I didn't get 10 out of 10. You're helping me know me, which I think is really helpful in the world. And also you're helping you know me too, which is very good for our relationship. And I'm less having to do the sort of double duty of keeping up appearances for you whilst working with something inside. And there are many places in our relational lives where we could be that for each other. And what that also had me thinking whilst you were talking about you and Grumpy and the whole situation, what gave birth to this in him and how you're working with it now, is to loop back to something you said right at the very beginning, which is to say, well, if I come to you, as I've done many times, to tell you about something I've done and how it's gone, everything, what's going on inside me is a whole family of parts of me that have learnt to respond in all of these different ways. And they may well have inside me many of the things that Dorothy Law Nolte writes about in her poem. And they have condemnation and fight and guiltiness and shyness and faith and all of these going on inside. You said something like, what you're starting to see is that you have a choice about how you respond when you bring something, which I think is very useful language. And sometimes I think the language of I can choose how I respond, what really helps us at that point is to go, I can choose how I relate to all of the different parts inside me that are having this reaction. Because sometimes the I can choose, like if I come and tell you something and I go, well, I can choose not to be ashamed, what I may inadvertently be doing is sort of bullying an inner part of me that feels ashamed not to be ashamed. I'm sort of giving myself a stern inner word. I'm going, don't be ashamed when you talk to Lizzie. And another way of looking at it is, for one reason or another, there's a part of me that feels really ashamed. Who do I need to be towards that part in order that that part can bring itself in the way that's most life-giving? And this is where the poem then becomes really helpful, because if I criticize my inner parts, they learn to condemn or to fight or to be shy.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've done is you've raised the question about how we the more spacious, timeless something of ourselves that we all are, takes care of and gets to help the parts of us that might, for very, very good reason, have a very tight and reactive view about what's going on and be flooding us with all of their feelings. So we get to be the parent, to wonder what it is to be the parent to the younger parts inside us that Dorothy Law Nolte was probably writing about, adult parents to their actual children, it's my guess, when she wrote it. But we get to ask that question of ourselves. And that's another whole realm of curiosity and possible creativity as well.
Mm. Yeah, I'm really appreciating, Justin, you kind of finding language, I guess, for the big journey in between compassion and understanding and having a choice. Because I know that those things are still there in me. I know that there's an avenue that goes, well, what about perfection? I know that. And yet I don't have to do that. But to get to that point is a journey. And I think one of the journeys that has really served me is all of the parts work that you and I know about, which enables me to find all of the attributes, if you like, of a life-giving, wholesome, healthy, psychologically sound parent on the inside of me, and asking that part of me how it would relate to 9 out of 10. And really doing that work, like really, really doing that, so that there is a sense of agency around my habitual learned behavior versus what I would like to cultivate in my life. And I'm really receiving this whole, you know, we can't just choose. And I totally agree. Like, there's so many times where I would like to be able to choose and I can't. And that's when I know I need to do some work. So when I can't make the choice, or it feels like I have to beat myself into submission somehow in order to make the choice, and it doesn't feel good and it doesn't feel possible or sustainable, that's the kind of, I need to go inward. Something needs to happen here, because there's some reactivity in me that's calling me, maybe from an unconscious place, maybe from a bit more conscious place, that I need to turn towards myself and my essential self in order to find the voice, the feeling that has a sane response, has a loving response, that has a life-giving response, like you said. And then that shows me how to deal with the situation. Like, there's so much within me that I didn't even know was within me that is that softness and is that kindness and is that strength, and whatever's called for seems to be here, but it's only here if I'm consciously turning towards it and I'm taking the invitations that my life is giving me, where I'm reactive or defensive or critical or whatever I'm being, taking those as openings, taking them as opportunities to do the work in service of me being in the situation next time and having some more agency than just coming out with my habitual old, same old self, which plenty of the time happens. So I'm feeling the hopefulness of what we're given here and what's possible, that we could entertain and nurture this relationship to self and have faith and trust that there's something here that really can help us. And thank goodness that that's true. And I want to thank Dorothy for writing this at the time that she wrote it, maybe in some way, in a kind of, this is what you should do kind of way. And I love that as things live on and they're in different people's hands, maybe she didn't, by the way, I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe it was parts work she was doing in 1954. But I love it that this is what we are able to do, to take something and all have different interpretations of it and work with it. And I just want to take a second to appreciate this practice that we do, Justin, where we have this thing between us and then we see what's born. And every single time, I can say without fail, something gets born here that's new to me, that feels like a new expression, that's a new kind of gem that unearths something beautiful and important every single time that we gather and we have these little jumping off points. They're not little, they're big. So I want to thank you, Justin, for diving off the board with me every time, and thanking everyone just for being here with us. And thank you for Dorothy, and thank you for all those therapist websites that I got to trawl through in service of finding us a source this weekend. And we'll be back with another source chosen by Justin next week on Sunday again.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.